This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today, we've got one of our favorite contributors. He's Dr. Thomas Williams. He is the Vice President of Science and Regulatory Affairs for Ortho Molecular Products, a maker of very fine nutritional supplements that I utilize with my patients. That's not something that generally is accessible in retail stores for the public. It's a professional line that health practitioners use. Tom teaches at the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy. He's a clinical instructor, and he's also the University of Minnesota School of Pharmacy. He is a PhD and a faculty member of the Fellowship in Anti-Aging, Regenerative, and Functional Medicine. He is also the author of some very fine books, some for health professionals, but his popular book, which is a really great book, it's called The Original Prescription, How the Latest Scientific Discoveries Can Help You Leverage the Power of Lifestyle Medicine. And we always turn to Tom Williams when we want to get the 411 on important looming medical issues, issues like the current pushback against supplements. It seems to be sort of a media circus about supplements in the last couple of months, right, Tom?
Yeah, good to be with you again, Ron. And yeah, there's so many issues coming at us from so many different angles. Good to be back at we can talk about some of these things.
Okay, well, first of all, there have been some articles, and one was amplified to great popular acclaim in the New York Times, which is and has some of my listeners and readers disconcerted. That says basically that all the hoopla about fish oil is exaggerated and the studies aren't there to substantiate the benefits of fish oils. And you are done very, very extensive research on fish oils. You're one of, I really consider you one of the go-to guys on the EPA-DHA science front. So give us the context, explain what that's about.
So, you know, as you probably cataloged many times on your show, there's been this constant mantra of repeated over and over of certain things in the industry, one of them being, you know, certain things don't work or certain things have stopped working or whatever. And this fish oil issue is one that keeps coming up. And interestingly, this issue, like many others, when you start looking at what has been published or what's been in the media and you start scrutinizing a little more, it falls apart very quickly. In fact, this latest one, you'll notice, didn't last very long. It's primarily because a lot of these are just repeats of older information. One of the things that came out, what happened to be the one that we're mentioning here, came out in JAMA Internal Medicine, and it was really it wasn't a new paper. It was just an editorial by the editorialist, essentially, of New England JAMA Internal Medicine. And essentially, they're lamenting the fact that, you know, randomized controlled trials seem to be all negative, but why are people still taking their fish oil? And, you know, it's something obviously they're very upset about and they want to, you know, lament about this. And so they publish a editorial, it's a 3-page editorial, and that becomes as if it's a new study, as if some new information has come out. And essentially, when you dig into that, what they're really saying is if they only look at what they call top-ranking internal medicine journals, New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, JAMA, et cetera, like five or six of these, and they say if we only look at those published in those journals, we find most of them that are negative. And their interpretation is, well, these must be the best clinical trials, because otherwise why would anybody not publish their best clinical trials in these journals? And you and I know that there's a lot of editorial bias for where a paper, especially a positive paper, for fish oil ends up. It certainly doesn't end up in JAMA or Annals of Internal Medicine or New England Journal very often. And perhaps there's a self-selection for large clinical trials that fail being published by these journals. So in essence, what is often being said, and this is also true of the latest vitamins cause cancer or vitamins cause bad health issues, it turns out that story also was just a review of previously published clinical trials, rehashed and put out into a new abstract, and it became a news story for 24 hours, 48 hours, until people realized there's really nothing new here. And unfortunately, this has sort of become the go-to way of dealing with information, especially when it comes to dietary supplements, is a rehashing of sometimes information that's 15 or 20 years old. It's very rare to hear somebody talk about supplements these days without trying to bring up a beta-carotene study, which was a synthetic beta-carotene study done in smokers over 20 years ago that had an increased risk of cancer in smokers. And somehow that information, even though there's been hundreds or thousands of papers since then, that somehow always is added on to every story because it seems to be one of those aha moments that scares people away from supplements. So unfortunately, we're left with the media and with a lot of editorial pages from journals really not taking seriously what it is that they do, which is, taking this information, vetting it correctly, placing it in context, and then giving real information to people. And it's unfortunate because it confuses not only patients but clinicians.
Well, you actually delve into the subject in your book, The Original Prescription. There's a chapter entitled How We Know What We Know, and it's about research itself. And sometimes the limitations and pitfalls of research, especially when it comes to nutritional science. So it seems to me that there's several ways you can go wrong. Sometimes you can test the wrong or an obsolete version of something that you want to debunk. So for example, if you want to say vitamin E is bad, you can use synthetic vitamin E or just narrow spectrum alpha tocopherol. You can use the wrong dose. That's another thing you could say, well, it doesn't work. But, you gave one fish oil pill to a bunch of people. You could also go wrong by, I call it the Lazarus effect. You give it to people on their last legs, like terminal cancer patients or patients who've, they're working on their third heart attack. And lo and behold, nutrition doesn't make much of a difference. Can you elaborate on how some of the limitations of the research?
When I put together the original prescription, that was one of those chapters that I think I even said in there, this could be one of the most important chapters of all the other things in here, because in the end, most things we write about eventually become obsolete. We try to write about principles and things that, are going to last forever, but that chapter where I say you need to, a person needs to know how to analyze or how to understand medical research, because in the 30-second or 60-second spot that you see on the news, they're not going to tell you this study was done and what the inclusion and exclusion criteria and all the different statistics that are involved in clinical trial. They're just going to say, this avoid this food or this thing, or take this and it's going to improve this. And the details that really help inform how important this is are really buried, unfortunately, inside these clinical trials. Let me give you an example. The one mantra that's been out for several years now is the idea of the use of B vitamins, especially folic acid or folates, in reducing homocysteine. And everyone seems to know that homocysteine levels increase your risk for heart disease and a number of other cardiovascular conditions. But in the trials that reduced homocysteine using folic acid and B6 and B12, we didn't see, or in some cases there wasn't, statistical drops in cardiovascular events, in heart attacks. And then you start asking the question, well, these patients all had previous heart attacks, like you mentioned. I wouldn't say this is the Lazarus effect, but it's close to it. These people are what we call secondary prevention. They've already had an event. 80% of them are on statin drugs, 90% of them on aspirin, 50% of them on some beta blocker, and others on calcium channel blockers, and go down the list. And then you say, well, we gave them 400 micrograms of folic acid, and it didn't do anything. And so therefore, we've concluded that the folic acid or homocysteine reduction doesn't benefit anyone. And so what I have, one of the things that I've been telling people is that we are slowly moving from what I used to call evidence-based medicine into an era where we have medicine-based evidence, where everything we try to approach has to be, first of all, done in medicated patients, because of course we can't, you know, it would be unsafe according to them to have people not on a statin. And second of all, the level of evidence that is now accepted, in fact, that's one of the things that's mentioned in this paper that I mentioned on the official Doesn't Work paper that came out of JAMA Internal Medicine. They're basically saying that hard endpoints, meaning, you know, somebody dies, meta-analysis, which represents the highest level of evidence. Well, do you know, there are only a handful of companies on the planet that can spend the money to create large enough clinical trials waiting for people to die to get hard evidence. And so in essence, the pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies are pushing what we deemed evidence really out of reach for everyone but them. And unfortunately, they're also the same people setting the guidelines or influencing the guidelines that are telling everyone you have to be on such and such.
So they're creating the rules of the game, but the people who create the rules of the game, you know, it'd be like having the Olympics in a host country which is hostile to America. They say, well, let's change the rules for basketball so we can make sure that there are no players over 6'2", because our native players here in Kazakhstan, they're not tall enough to compete with NBA basketball players.
Right. And the irony of that is that the biomarkers, let's say in our case, let's say the LDL cholesterol or triglycerides, those biomarker changes in LDL cholesterol were the original reason why statins, for instance, became drugs. They lowered LDL cholesterol. That was the claim. Now that they've got the claim and they've been able to spend, you know, obviously billions and maybe even trillions of dollars now in research, they now can say, okay, we now move on to death or cardiovascular disease or specific outcomes. And now if you have a drug that just lowers LDL cholesterol, we're sorry, you can't get into the game because now the new evidence is higher than that. And so when they look back at, for instance, fish oil, and we say, look, we can reduce inflammatory markers, fish oil has an effect on triglycerides, fish oil, and we can name all the different things that we, you know, CRP and all the things that we may list as intervention with fish oil, they'll say, sorry, those biomarkers are no longer acceptable. We need hard evidence. We need, you know, the highest level of evidence, and so far, so you guys are playing in sort of the shallow end of the pool.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's really taking, like I said, we're taking evidence-based medicine and we're making it medicine-based evidence, and it's easy to have this elitist status that makes it very difficult to use this information.
Well, you saw the headlines recently that were generated by the vitamins can cause cancer story. And we've discussed this a little bit on Intelligent Medicine. We've had Dr. Lee Zalschuler with a very excellent discussion of the relationship between nutrients and cancer. And we published her rebuttal to that on our website. And I wrote my own rebuttal to it. But, you know, what's your take on that? I mean, do you have some specific concerns about the quality of that research?
Well, I find it really interesting. I wrote an editorial a little over a year and a half ago when the, you know, don't spend your money on vitamin article came out. And I really spoke about this idea that in no other field of medicine would somebody catalog ascorbic acid, which is obviously a specific antioxidant compound, with a fat-soluble compound like vitamin E, with a complex B12, which is a very complex, and say all together, we're just going to lump all these together, right, and call them one thing, and somehow this is going to be some meta-analysis. So nobody would do that unless they're viewing vitamins, as it were, as an outsider, as a collection of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you really start digging into those specific pieces of research, almost all of them need to be taken on a case-by-case basis and understand, is this an anomaly of the patient population? Many people know that people with higher risk for cancer in the family are
they're going to be taking vitamins.
Supplement.
Yeah.
So you have all of these other factors, and when you ask the question about biological plausibility, what is the mechanism that would lead someone to believe that, you know, beta carotene or ascorbic acid or folic acid or whatever could increase the risk for cancer, let's say, when epidemiological data suggests that, that people who consume more of these things have a reduced risk of cancer? The answer is we don't know. So rather than asking those questions and teasing them out and figuring this out in a scientific way, it just gets lumped into this thing where editorial pages come in. It's too dangerous to take these because we're not sure. And as you know, and as I know, when we look into specific details of those clinical trials, we find out there's all kinds of problems. Namely, in some cases, they're not statistically significant, that when you start looking at them, the fact that, for instance, when folic acid was considered to be raised the risk for colon cancer in one particular clinical trial, that made news everywhere. But when we've seen meta-analysis after meta-analysis that has looked at all folic acid interventions, and they basically say there's no increased risk for colon cancer, when was that ever editorialized? When was that brought into the evening news that, no, there was an anomaly in the one study that we let you know about, and there's really no risk anymore? And you, I think you probably talked about the Fred Hutchinson study where they looked at a different trial, which was for selenium and prostate cancer,
right.
And they noted that people with slightly elevated, and we're talking enough to a difference of a fish sandwich right before you walked in to get the blood draw, a slight difference in DHA versus EPA in the blood levels of certain individuals seemed to have a higher risk of prostate cancer. But when they looked at that, they asked the question, were any of these individuals taking fish oil? They didn't ask the question. So what came out from the news articles is fish oil raises your risk of prostate cancer. But the study didn't look at fish oil consumption, and the difference between the two groups was non-significant. So when you start looking at individual papers, you realize that this is a red herring, but clinicians who have an agenda and who have a platform will often mention these things as proof of their position, and yet it's not like a news conference where somebody can ask a follow-up question. They get off the stage, and somebody writes what they wrote, and it becomes the New York Times front page.
So this is a difficult question, but how do you think consumers can arm themselves so that they can be wary of data manipulation? And it can happen on both sides. I mean, there are supplements who are, you know, and I think you'll acknowledge there's some people in our industry who push fly-by-night supplements on the basis of, quote, evidence, where they may have actually paid, you know, a small research facility or college in India to look at 12 patients. And, you know, who knows if they're honestly transcribing the data. And then they say this is an amazing, you know, testosterone boosting or life enhancing miracle breakthrough.
Well, yeah, and I trust me, I spend as much time, unfortunately, fighting that side as I do fighting the other side. So I feel like in some ways I am trying to be a referee within even the integrative medicine and vitamin supplement world as
right.
far as publications.
And also, you're the scientific advisor for Orthomolecular. So, you know, you have probably spent a lot of time vetting new products. You know, manufacturers come to you pitching you saying,
yeah.
hey, this is going to be the next best thing. And I know that Orthomolecular is they're progressive but conservative at the same time, which is the best possible. You know, they're adopting innovative products, but they also don't want to, you know, get too far across the bleeding edge of innovation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously everybody, you know, it goes both ways. The consumer and even the clinician in our world always wants something new. You know, I want something new, not something new, and so everybody wants to give them something new. And so there's always people repackaging things, renaming things. Sometimes they're not even new, they're just renamed, and then coming out with new things. And vetting that is a full-time job. And unfortunately, the long-term answer is for those who are in charge of peer-reviewed literature, the journals, to be honest about their biases and allow, you know, have a good panel of people on their staff who understand the level of evidence that is we can publish. You know, good scrutiny, but allow that evidence to get out, saying, here, this is the information, and the study was done well, and here's the evidence. Unfortunately, there's a lot of manipulation of the data, a lot of, even in editorials telling them that this data, really bury this data, I don't want this in the abstract.
This is on the conventional side. This is on the drug side.
This is on the conventional side. Like, yeah. I mentioned, in the book, I mentioned the study that was published on, it's called the GATE trial, which is about glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, and the authors wanted to put within the abstract the data on, it turned out to be very positive data on the use of glucosamine and chondroitin in moderate to severe pain. And in fact, they got more statistical reduction in moderate to severe pain using glucosamine and chondroitin than they did using Celebrex. But the editors of the journal said, no, we won't allow you to put that in the abstract. We want you to put that essentially buried in the bottom of the paper. And when the guy went to a meeting, he made it sound like, hey, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, because this really worked well. And there was a lot of media attention. But when the publication came out, in a sense, the editor said, we're going to force you to, in a sense, bury that in the paper. So the editors of a journal have a lot to do with how things are presented and in what manner they're presented. And a lot of that is based on either known bias or even unknown bias, especially to the industry. The long-term solution is that we're able to have, and I think open access journals are good in the sense that they allow more things to get out there, but they don't have as much vetting. We don't have as much peer review in some of the open access journals, which then becomes a problem.
So they could really be like fly-by-night journals that are not really scientifically rigorous, where there's an element of sometimes pay to play, where you say, hey, I'll run a full page ad, for my product, and maybe you'll cast a more favorable eye on my paper.
Yeah, certainly that's out there, but even one of the frustration that researchers have, and you can talk to researchers for years, is, I've got this paper, I've written it, and I want to get it out there. And it used to be, in the old days, when we only had print journals, there was this, lock and key, the gatekeepers would really prevent what got published and what not. Mm-hmm. And with open access, it's more open, which is good, but the speed of which these things get out means that there's less scrutiny on some of the open access journals, and even in the other journals, because there's a rush to deliver this, and you see this with the media, people getting stories out, they want to be the first one, and so they don't fact check as often as they do, mm-hmm. as they should. Well, this is happening in the scientific world as well. People aren't fact checking as much, they're not peer reviewing as long, getting as many people involved, and making quicker decisions, sometimes, which is good because we get information faster, but probably we're not getting as good of information. So I think the balance between recognizing the biases that are there and then being able to get more information out is going to help us. I think the media is going to sensationalize either the good or the bad because that's what they do. I don't know that we can change the media. And for my part, is to be willing to be just as critical within the industry and within, what's going on and people promoting things, because you're right, there is a bias for people not to see negative articles or to promote something with three mice in a cage and then, taking that information and saying, right, this is evidence that it'll cure your cancer or something.
Right.
We need to be cautious of that.
There is that mouse to human thing, we have cured more killer diseases in mice. More mice are running on treadmills who are paralyzed. We've cured paralysis, cancer, heart disease many times over with either pharmaceutical drugs or natural compounds. But, does that necessarily mean that consumers should be taking a product?
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that I emphasize in that chapter, what we know, or how we know what we know, is the idea that one of the first questions you need to ask, I think I listed at the end, what kind of study was it? And if you know what kind of study it was, then you can say, okay, if there's a big difference between, you know, a large clinical trial, which was an intervention trial with the product that you're using in human beings over a long period of time, versus one of the chemical compounds was put on cells. Now, that chemical compound put on the cells could help understand or make a bridge between how things work and the mechanisms, and that's very important information, but it's not the same information. And what I typically try to do when I'm developing products and looking at ingredients is I want to see information that goes all the way from the cell to animal studies to epidemiology and then intervention trials. If I have all of those, that's obviously the best, because then I have a better understanding of not only how it works, but what the mechanisms are, and that the mechanisms will tell me, is it likely to have an interaction that I don't know about yet because of the way it works? Mm-hmm. Or can it be synergistic with something because of the way two things work? And so it's very important to have as much information as possible, but always ask the question, what kind of study is it? And that's usually, if you don't know the answer to that question, then you probably should stop and not make any conclusions before you figure that out.
Oh, absolutely. All right, in part two, let's switch gears. We'll talk about some practical suggestions for a diet and lifestyle. You'll find those in a great book, The Original Prescription, by today's guest, Dr. Thomas Gwilliams, How the Latest Scientific Discoveries Can Help You Leverage the Power of Lifestyle Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Please join us for part two coming up. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.